So Democrat Chris Bell ran ads criticizing the Accenture contract. We had two independent candidates, Carol Keaton Strayhorn and Kinky Friedman, both criticizing the contract during the campaign. And meanwhile, Governor Perry's camp was defending the contract, saying that all the problems were solvable.
So, and this is again, you know, I think emphasizes just the incredible role that politics played in this unfolding and in the damage it caused. We knew, the contractor knew, the state knew, I think the media knew, we knew that the technology wasn't working. The vendor had brought in an interface that was supposed to allow these call center operators to quickly input data, from, you know, information received from clients into the state's big computer system, which hadn't initially been set up to work in a call center environment. That technology, that interface didn't work, which led to them having to do double data entry into one system and then into another. That played a big role in slowing down the contractor. But the legislature continued to push the state agency and its contractor to push ahead. There was an enormous amount of pressure to achieve the savings that had been built into the budget several years earlier, and really not to lose steam, not to, give the critics, people like us, an opportunity to try and slow it down because it wasn't working. And just to give you one example, the state representative who authored the legislation that set all of this in motion, there was held a hearing because things were slowing down. There were some delays in which she demanded, quote, that they go faster, faster, faster. So they completely ignored all the warning signs that things were going badly. Later, the Office of Inspector General for the state agency testified that this was a major event that should never have happened had anyone heeded those warning signs. And at the same time that it was becoming an issue in the governor's race, I think Governor Perry's camp was looking ahead to the next presidential race, and there was a lot of concern that this not become an indictment of privatization, because when President Bush was governor, he'd initially sought privatization. It had led to where we were with this contract, and they clearly didn't want it to undermine efforts around the country and nationally to privatize government services.
So the problems were widespread. The USDA, which pays for the food in the food stamp program and splits the administrative costs with the state, was warning Texas that backlogs, long hold times, lack of training at the call centers were contributing to poor service and client frustration. And soon after that, the state halted the call center pilot. That was welcome news to Jake Billingsley, a guy I interviewed in Austin. He had met the application deadline for renewing his food stamps, but received them late after the deadline. He was 57. He said that other Texans on food stamps may not have the backyard resources that he had. He told me, "I'm fortunate that I'm a gardener and I grow a lot of my own fresh vegetables." In September of 2009, tens of thousands of Texans were waiting as long as several months for food stamps. Mary Bidwell of the San Antonio area told me that she used to receive $111 a month in food stamps, but the amount suddenly dropped to zero. She told me, "It made me so mad I couldn't go to sleep." She was 67, she was retired, and she relied on food stamps to get her fresh fruits and vegetables. And she told me, "Well, hey, here comes the beans and tortillas again." The USDA warned that Texas was going to have to process its food stamp applications more quickly or risk losing federal funds. I also talked with Gracie De Jesus. She was from Kyle, south of Austin. She was 35 years old, and she said she waited 64 days to get her food stamps renewed. She visited food stamps. She frantically called the call center to check on her application status. She told me, "I was just absolutely in tears." De Jesus was a bookkeeper and a mother of four kids. She said, "I got tired of feeding my kids cans of spinach." Finally, she visited a state benefits office and refused to leave until she got her $700 in monthly benefits. It worked. But by then, she had fallen behind on rent and electricity, and her water had been cut off. Another guy I talked to was Rick Carey in San Antonio. He was a disabled Persian Gulf War vet. He told me he submitted multiple applications for food stamps after his doctor told him to stop working because of a heart condition. He said state workers kept telling him that they never received his application, even though he had received a letter saying that they had. And he and his wife would go to a benefits office to try and talk to a state worker, and they would have to wait in line for an hour just to get their name on a waiting list. He tried to avoid going to an office, but he said he could never get through by phone. And he told me, we called, nobody ever answered. Trust me, I'm big on leaving messages, and I've never left a message with them. In December 2006, Governor Rick Perry's Health and Human Services Chief, Albert Hawkins, announced that Texas was significantly scaling back the Accenture contract. Hawkins said, what we found is that we didn't draw the line between vendor work and state work in the right place. And under the new agreement, state workers were going to continue to make the final decision about whether to approve an application, but contractors would no longer decide whether an applicant had submitted the right information. In March 2007, Texas and Accenture agreed to end the deal. Both sides said that they couldn't agree on financial terms of the revamped deal. And supporters and critics of outsourcing both said that the end of the deal validated their philosophy. Critics said it showed that privatization is not the way to improve services, and supporters said that if a private company fails to meet expectations, the state can hold that company accountable in a way that just isn't possible for state workers. During the 2007 legislative session, state lawmakers approved Governor Perry's reappointment of Hawkins as Health and Human Services Chief, but only after they grilled him about the case of Devontae Johnson. Devontae was a Houston boy who died of kidney cancer in March of that year after his mother had difficulty renewing his Medicaid coverage. He was 14.
Did you want to...
Yeah, to give you some context on the frustration. Imagine you're, a single mom, and you're wanting to check on your food stamp benefits, and you call, and maybe your kids are already enrolled in Medicaid or something like that. I'll just play this snippet of an IVR system.
Hold while I gather your case information. Our records show that your case includes the following program: food stamps, medical assistance, TANF. The status of food stamps is approved, and it has been approved for $526. For the month of November, the status of medical assistance is approved. The status of medical assistance is approved. The status of medical assistance is denied. 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 The status of TANF is denied. Note, these amounts may not reflect the actual amount issued due to adjustments.
So you can imagine that was part of the implementation, the confusion that a client might face when they're calling in to get answers.
So this slide sort of shows you the before. The top line sort of represents kind of what was envisioned at the very beginning of the contract of who would do what. And so they had, it's hard to see the white line, I guess, but initially the privatized operations, the private contractor staff were really going to be responsible for almost everything, every act involved in figuring out who was eligible leading up to that actual decision, which is an important point with privatization because the federal law actually prohibits states from allowing private sector employees to figure out who's eligible for government services. It's considered an inherently governmental function. So there was a big argument up front about whether we were actually doing that, because if figuring out how much income someone has and how many people are in their family and what assets they have, all of the steps that go into figuring out if someone's eligible, how do you divorce that decision-making, that information-gathering function from the ultimate decision? And that's really what they did. They said, we're going to have mostly low-paid, unskilled staff collecting all the information. Then we're going to send it over to this much smaller cadre of state workers who will make the decision. And we really pushed as advocates the federal government and Congress to say, no, you can't do that. That's you're turning over an inherently governmental function to a private sector worker, and that's against federal law. The other thing it did was this sort of hybrid approach, is that there was no accountability for the final decision, at least in the contract staff. What they were responsible for was collecting a piece of information, documenting that they collected that, entering into the system. And once they did that, check, that task is done. But when it came to figuring out who was eligible and whether the decision got made and whether it was rightly made and whether it was on time, They weren't accountable for that. And I think that's kind of what you're hearing a little bit in this IVR, is at least it's the sense it gives me of total frustration because clients couldn't get someone to be accountable for the decisions that were being made. We couldn't get figure out who was accountable for the decisions being made. You know, ultimately, there was no system in place to troubleshoot. Nobody was left, you know, holding the bag in terms of being responsible. So that's what they'd envisioned at first. And then Commissioner Hawkins realized that wasn't working and greatly, greatly scaled back the role that the contractor was going to play. And this initially happened 4 months after the pilot was launched. And then they were in kind of a holding pattern up until December in terms of actually making a contract adjustment. And then a couple months later, as Corey pointed out, the contract was actually canceled. But in the meantime, we realized, didn't draw the line in the right place. We're going to need to get our state staff who know what they're doing to take over so that the contractor can catch up and we can figure out where to go from here. The problem was we didn't have any state staff left over because we'd fired them all. And at the same time that the case, the number of workers was decreasing rapidly, you can see that the blue line, that's the workload. So the workload had increased dramatically, and we had a much smaller workforce than we'd had just 6 months prior. And in addition, we had a much less tenured workforce. Do we have the graph that shows that? So back in September 2004, about 8%, you know, less than 10% of the workforce had less than 2 years of experience. By June of 2009, over half of the workforce had less than 2 years of experience. In addition to not having the type of tenure that the original state workforce had, the workers were completely demoralized. And Corey's going to talk a little bit more about that in a second. They were demoralized. They'd lost confidence in their bosses at the state. They'd lost confidence in the new approach. They had zero confidence in the new computer system. It had almost become this $1 billion joke with the workers themselves not feeling like it could do what it needed to do to support their work. And I'll just tell you a quick story. I got the opportunity to sit down next to a person working the new computer system, Tears, and sat through a few interviews because I really wanted to understand what the difficulties were with it, what the problems were. And he kept going back and forth between the actual screen of the new computer system and this Microsoft Word document, which I noted was 80 pages long. And I said, "What is that?" And he said, "This is where I keep a record of everything I do because I don't trust the system to keep a record." So that just gives you a sense of where the employees were mentally in their minds and in terms of numbers when the state first realized that maybe it had made a little bit of a mistake.
So in December 2009, USDA warned states against outsourcing efforts like the ones in Texas and also in Indiana. And the USDA wrote, many eligible applicants have suffered. That month, Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid sued the state on behalf of several families caught in the backlog. And the lawsuit told these stories, told stories of families waiting to receive calls from caseworkers on the days of scheduled interviews and never receiving those calls, waiting hours at food stamp offices without seeing their caseworker, calling offices repeatedly without being able to reach their caseworker or leave a message. One of the plaintiffs said that she applied for food stamps in early July after her hours were cut at a telemarketing job. Her name was Amalia Gadea Nelson. She was still waiting in December. She told me, "If you try to call, they're busy. After hours, there's no way to leave a message. It takes longer to try and get food stamps than it does to get a job." And the economic downturn complicated things because more people were applying for food stamps. A state spokeswoman told me that the agency saw too many cases just falling through the cracks. And she told me, "One of our fears, frankly, is there an application just sitting on a state worker's desk somewhere?" And that's what Ms. Gadea Nelson told me was her fear, too. She told me, "Did I get lost? Was I misplaced?" State officials said they didn't have enough staff trained in Tears to process all the applications. Turnover was high. One supervisor told me employees are on the verge of a nervous breakdown. At one point, the new head of the Health and Human Services Commission, Tom Cease, wrote an email to employees asking for feedback, and he got it. More than 500 employees wrote him back and told him about how difficult things were for them. They talked about low morale, low pay, training problems, technology problems. They told him they felt frazzled, that they cried on their way to work when they were driving in. One supervisor in South Texas wrote, "I've been with the agency 21 years. I've never seen it this bad. We can't work like this anymore. Morale is low, but we come to work every day with the hope that things will get better." And Cease responded by hiring more workers, giving bonuses to workers, telling them that he was suspending mandatory overtime over Thanksgiving and Christmas, and he told employees in an email, "I want you home in time for dinner."
So this brings us to the happier part of our presentation, which is talking about how things turned around and what fixes were put in place, because we're definitely in a better place today than we were, you know, just 2 years ago. But it's always hard to say. It was very hard during the meltdown to say who or what was to blame. And I know Corey who interviewed me countless times in the last 5 years about it. That was the first question she asked: whose fault is it?
Yeah.
Is it the state's fault? Is it the vendor's fault? Is it this particular vendor's fault? And obviously it wasn't just one bad egg vendor, because the vendors that we were using then we're still using, and they're doing other good things in service to the state of Texas. It wasn't necessarily the commissioner of Health and Human Services at the time. It was very much the product of the things we've all discussed all along: the need to cut costs and you know, keep in mind the politics of the situation and all of those things. So it's and similarly, I think in addition, it's hard to figure out who is to blame, it's also to figure out exactly who to credit for the turnaround. Now, if my boss were here, he'd tell me to take full credit for it. So I'm just going to say that we definitely played a role, as did Corey's reporting. but I'm just going to touch on a couple of the things. I think there was some really key pressure points, most of which occurred in the fall of 2009. I think that really created the space for the people who were in charge to start making the changes they needed to. First was the federal lawsuit that Corey had mentioned. That was filed in July of 2009. It was a federal class action lawsuit. Depending on how far it went, it was going to be a big embarrassment for the state of Texas, regardless, I think, of the outcome. About a month after that federal lawsuit was filed, USDA, the federal agency, the feds that are in charge of the food stamp program, they sent a letter to the state demanding corrective action. At the time, less than half of food stamp applications were being processed on time. We had wait times of up to 6 months for benefits. We had offices getting applications and not even being able to open them for 90 days. So it was probably the worst. It was the lowest point in the whole five-year period. And so the feds stepped in. And again, hearkening back to the importance of politics, this was now a new administration. President Obama had been elected. We had a new leadership at the federal agency. And they were finally able to step in and say, you can't do this, and you have to make changes, and we're going to demand a fix. The problem was, it was not an easy problem to fix. There was no easy solution. There were a couple of things that helped. The legislature in 2009, because it saw what was coming and it saw that things were really bad, had included a provision in the budget that said if things stay this bad and you can't meet your federal requirements and you're in danger of lawsuits and things like that, you have the permission to ask us for more staff, up to 800. And so when things after the lawsuit and the demand for corrective action, the agency, the commissioner, executive commissioner, went to the leadership, went to the governor's office and said, we need those staff, and they were granted them. And having that infusion of you know, additional bodies on the street really did help, although the training issues and the overworked workers, the overtime, that was still a problem. But just getting more bodies in the door played a big role. And then we also had a new executive commissioner who was really, you know, empowered. He's done a wonderful job, and we credit a lot of the fix to him, Executive Commissioner Tom Cease. But he was able to make those changes because he was empowered, again, by the governor's office and the leadership. They recognized this was becoming an embarrassment for Texas, and they empowered him to make what changes he needed to. They gave him essentially the latitude to look at policy and figure out how can we skip this step and you know, go as far as we can to simplify the process to make it easier for our workers to get the job done. And I think the email that Corey talked about, his email to state workers, is a great example of what he was empowered to do that the former commissioner wasn't, which was to reach out and say, we need your help. We made a mistake. We're here for you. We want you to be part of the solution. And that's a big difference from the previous commissioner who was really, you know, there was never any admission that there was a problem. The whole faster, 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 the faster we go, the quicker things will work. He would never have been empowered to send out that kind of an email to employees. And in fact, when the state held the only hearings it ever did for the public to comment on the whole new approach and the reduction in force and the privatization, they held those hearings on the last day of the month on a Friday, which is the day that eligibility staff have the biggest workload because they're in charge of getting everything, all their cases turned around in time on that day. And at one of those hearings, a state worker, or at a meeting actually that was held along around that time, a state worker actually got up and said to the commissioner at the time, "Do you even know what we do?" And he didn't. The leadership didn't know what they did or was not allowed to seek, you know, their input. And everything was completely different for Commissioner Cease. He was really able to go out and ask employees to go out. And he has actually spent numerous, you know, days, hours, weeks in sitting next to eligibility workers and figuring out what they do. And that's played a big role in helping the state to figure out, helping the agency figure out what they need to do differently. And then finally, in addition to new staff and empowered leadership, the state brought in expertise from other states that had gone through similar problems and had come out at the other end of the tunnel and knew and had successfully rolled out similar computer systems. And just getting that sort of getting someone in with fresh eyes and a really great attitude and a sort of this can be done, we can turn these things around, really kind of created the stage for the progress that we've made since September of 2009. And I think you can kind of see that on the screen. You can see just this is a massive drop in timeliness, which is really the primary way we have of measuring performance in the system is, are we getting people benefits in a reasonable period of time? Because clearly families that are hungry can't wait, you know, more than a month to get help. And then the other is, are we giving them the right amount of benefits, which is known as payment accuracy? And that was another thing that really tanked during this whole process. But as you can see now, and this has been true for a number of months now, we are meeting those federal timeliness standards. Our new computer system is rolled out statewide. And I think we're not out of the woods yet. We still have a workforce that is largely working a lot of overtime hours. And the state knows and has admitted that it's not going to get any more staff. And so the challenge now, I mean, we've stabilized. I think of it as sort of triage. We've stabilized. But the challenge now is we know the Texas population is going to continue to grow. And we know that the number of people in poverty, which drives demand for these services, is going to continue to grow. On top of that, we had passage of the National Health Reform Act, which by 2014 in Texas is projected to add up to 2 million more people to our Medicaid rolls because of changes in the Affordable Care Act. So I think the state is bracing itself to be potentially overwhelmed yet again. And so everything they're doing right now is about figuring out, well, how do we take the lessons learned from this nightmare and do the right thing this time? We know we need to modernize. There may be a role for private contractors in that modernization. What do we do now? And there are a couple of things that have happened that really have, I think, put sort of the whole modernization train back on the right track. At the Health and Human Services Agency, they've established an eligibility modernization project that is at the executive level, so it has executive-level buy-ins, which means it can make decisions and implement them quickly. They've enhanced the online application, the self-serve, what they call the self-service portal, in the hopes that they can get more and more people applying online and being able to submit documents and check the status of their cases online, and that in turn will reduce the workload for actual staff. And they're really working very hard to engage a real committed army of community partners and give them the training and the resources they need to be able to help people apply for benefits so that when the application actually hits that state worker's desk, it's complete, it's accurate, it's got the right information, and it's easy for that state worker to review it and make a decision. So I think all of those things are ingredients in what we hope is the path to success.
And also just making it easier for, as an applicant, when you walk into an office to that the offices themselves would be easier to navigate. You wouldn't have to go to an office, but if you did, that it would be easy to figure out what to do once you got there. And the situation now with the contractors is that the state is no longer working with Accenture on this. They had been the lead contractor in the original deal, but Maximus, which had been a subcontractor in the original deal, is now running those call centers.
And one more point on this, from sort of the vendor perspective, the state did a really good job of integrating state employees at every level, literally sitting with and approving pretty much most of the main decisions, and they gave them opportunities to make suggestions and implement those suggestions. And a lot of really good people worked really hard on the vendor side to help with that as well.
So what were the lessons learned? I think planning is probably the first and most important step when a state is undertaking new technology, new business processes, especially when there is so much at stake, not just in terms of taxpayer dollars, but just the enormous human costs that occurred as a result of not planning properly that we've talked about today. I think on the IT side, one of the most interesting things I heard about sort of what was important for the actual company to do when they're trying to figure out how to help states modernize is they need to really understand they need to be asked the same question that state worker asked the old commissioner is, do you know what we do? They need to understand how complicated a process it is. Legislators that were supportive of this type of approach and worked very hard to get it off the ground always like to liken it to applying for a mortgage online or checking your bank balance. Well, it isn't at all. It's much more complicated than that, and very bureaucratic. And so I think one of the best recommendations that I heard was that the vendor actually sit down, shoulder to shoulder in an eligibility office or in a call center and watch the worker do their job for a number of months, kind of like what Commissioner Cease is now doing out in the field. So definitely planning, including a contingency plan. We had no contingency plan for if we just said it's going to work, and the pilot was really more of a soft launch than it was an opportunity to test and evaluate. And when things went south 4 months after the pilot was launched and we decided we had drawn the line in the wrong place, we didn't have anybody. We didn't have anybody left, and that's why it's taken so many years to pick up the pieces. Realistic and flexible timelines. As I've said a number of times already today, we are under an enormous amount of pressure to cut costs. That was the driving force. It was not client access to services. It was not good technology. It was not making state workers' lives easier. It was all about cutting the budget. And that forced unrealistic and inflexible timelines that proved to be disastrous. And then adequate resources. One of the things that the old commissioner liked to say when he got pressure, it sort of pushed by the legislature when they weren't seeing the hundreds of millions of dollars in savings that they'd been promised was, we will achieve those savings. The question is when. And I do think there's a great opportunity. There are lots of opportunities here to make the system more efficient so it costs the state less to run it. But making the kinds of complex and involved changes that were envisioned in this contract involves devoting significant resources, including potentially even beefing up your staff so that you have more support units when things go wrong. And we approached it from the opposite direction. And then testing and evaluation are very important. There was no testing, as I mentioned earlier, of the interface that was brought in to help enter information into our computer system. There was no time built into the pilot to evaluate. It was, we're going to do this for 4 months in a two-county area, and then the schedule was already there for taking it statewide because that was what was needed to achieve the savings in the budget. So definitely building in time to test and evaluate. And the reason this isn't often done is that again, if it's a system that has to work, you have to proceed with, you don't necessarily want to evaluate and find out it doesn't work because then you have to go back to go to plan B. And if you haven't planned, there may not be a plan B. And then finally, I think that one of the biggest lessons for states and policymakers and advocates and the media to take away from all this is to really question when outsourcing of government services is appropriate. There are a lot of potential advantages. It can give state governments and the federal government The ability to meet demands that are beyond current government capacity. The private sector can often bring in capital. They can offer the potential to reduce costs through increased competition and service quality. And then, you know, there's also, I think, just the ideology at work is that the private sector does everything better than government. On the risk side of things, you're giving up public responsibility for public funds. So, and that in turn can threaten accountability. Kind of like what I talked about earlier, there not being anyone accountable for that ultimate decision about who is eligible. Well, that should be the agency administrator appointed by the elected official, and then ultimately you lose some of that when you privatize. There's a lot of potential for fraud, conflicts of interest, cost overruns, things like that. And any cost savings you get from privatization don't necessarily go back into improving the quality of services, but are profits for the contractor, which creates a lot of heartburn for some people. And then, of course, similar to the ideology that the private sector does everything better, there are a lot of people who think the government does everything better and the government should do everything. So I think that what the experience of states in this contract and other states really says about outsourcing is that, you know, it's not like the government does everything right or the private sector does everything right. It's that some functions are best kept done by state employees, others are best contracted out. And the challenge is for states to figure out what falls into which category and to avoid making the decisions based on sort of generic assumptions about who does what best or ideological to preferences. And I think finally, what states need to consider when they turn over money and responsibility to a private sector operator is, do the benefits of outsourcing outweigh the risks? And in this case, I think clearly they didn't. That's not to say that there's not a role for private companies to play as we move forward with modernization and that we won't continue to partner with them. Just that, again, as Commissioner Hawkins said, we drew the line in the wrong place this time.
Okay, it's 11:41, and that concludes our presentation. However, we have plenty of time for questions, if anybody has any questions for the panel. Yeah,
it's obviously a very complex situation right here. I guess I'm curious, what is your opinion as to that fifth point right here? Because on the one hand, this was obviously something, outsourcing and privatization is something that is, you know, I live here in Texas, so I've had, you know, I'm aware of these discussions going on. It was obviously a very old system, and IT is maybe not necessarily something that government is good at, but as y'all have noted, this was something that required lots of specialization on the part of the workers, and when you're talking about providing food stamps, providing benefits, that is something where you would want to have a high level of accountability, and obviously there's a lot of risk involved with it going wrong. So I'm just curious, do you think that this was something that was appropriate to be outsourced, and do you have any other thoughts as to maybe going forward, any sort of framework that could be applied when looking at outsourcing government services, aside from just a basic, simplistic, libertarian, should government be doing this? Any thoughts on that?
Sure. So it's a good question, and it's a question that I struggled with for quite some time. You know, I'm an advocate. At 26 years old, I was responsible for my disabled mother. I became her guardian. At that point, I went back to study public policy to try to work in some of these issues. And at first, in my personal opinion, I thought privatization was a good thing, partially a libertarian view. But when I worked on this project, my view changed quite a bit. And I think one of the main reasons for that was, the analogy I like to use is if you're to hire a plumber, let's say, you know, the requirement for that plumber is to come and fix your toilet. And if it doesn't leak, he's succeeded. He or she has succeeded. This particular project, it wasn't clear, you know, what those tasks were. And everybody knew that. One area I think where privatization works well is the processing of the mail. So there's an operation in Midland that opens up mail. Scans it, and they follow a finite set of requirements, and they do, you know, relatively good job. It's all about knowing your operation well enough to where you think you can train people to do repeatable processes. If you can find those situations, personally, I think privatization is a good thing. Most importantly, if you're going to do that, it's really important to make public what those requirements are, what the vendor is measured against, and whether or not they meet those requirements on a monthly basis. I firmly believe that.
Yeah, I think it comes down to, I mean, setting aside, I think when you privatize, you're giving up a lot in terms of you're losing state capacity that you might not get back. And I think that's something that needs to be kept in mind. But when it comes to sort of making the decision, you know, is it worth it? Does it make sense here? Is it going to help us deliver better services at a lower cost, which I think are the two overarching goals? I think what it comes down to is can you design a contract that measures performance? And to do that, you have to agree on what success means. So in the case of a plumber fixing your toilet not leaking is success, and everybody can agree to that. In the case of opening the mail and filing the mail and scanning documents so that they're readable, it's easy. That's success. It's easy to agree on that. When it comes to figuring out who should get things like food stamps and Medicaid, it's a lot harder. I can say what I would define success as. It's every possible eligible person who wants that help getting it. But that's not success for somebody else might be, let's reduce the roles. Let's reduce the welfare roles. People are overusing government services. Let's get them back to work. And so there you might have a performance measure we're going to incentivize you reducing the number of people who are on the roles. So when you can't agree on what success is, it's really hard to design a contract. A good example, I did a lot of research on privatization of child protective services. Something else Texas considered privatizing, and it never got off the ground. A child is potentially in danger in their home, yet everybody agrees that the best place for a child to be, if they can be kept there safely, is in the home. So do you design a contract that rewards the vendor for removing kids from the home, or do you design a contract that rewards the contractor for keeping as many kids as possible in the home? So when you get those sort of murkier, you can't agree to what the outcome should be, I think that's when you have to say it doesn't make sense for us to privatize.
I just had a question regarding how can social media really help or hinder social services? And I was wondering what the future of playing into that and helping, I guess, raise awareness and raise outlook and basically raise connectivity for people with disabilities or people who are not necessarily privy to all the different services that are available to someone who's has had means to be able to find what they need to find.
Thanks for asking the question. At one point I was managing the quality control team for the call center with the vendor for Medicaid, TANF, and food stamps. And every now and then I was able to listen to a call. And it was during the food stamp crisis. And there was a woman that turned in her application on time, but her appointment was going to be 6 or 8 weeks down the road. However, her benefits were going to expire within 2 weeks. And, the agent really couldn't help her at that point. I started to think, what is the enrollment percentage? What is the participation rate? And Celia, what is it for Texas?
Probably about 2/3 of eligible people.
Yeah.
So that's way up from where it was about 5 years ago.
So when I read that number, think about it, 2/3 of the people that qualify for food stamps actually apply. I got really, really curious about that. And I just started asking why. I mean, and so there's two things I think that contribute to why aren't people finding the services that they need. One of the reasons is there's a stigma associated. So people know about it. There's a group of that people know about it. They know they qualify for those services, but they just don't want to do it. So I got on the internet and I said, if I'm in Houston and I'm in need, where do I go? And I started to look, and there was a big needle in a haystack effect. The design of information, there's a lot of complicated industries. Travel, for example, before, all of the travel sites, or buying insurance, or they're complicated industries. A project that I'm working on now is actually using sort of Web 2.0 with a friendly face, that essentially curates the information that's available so people can essentially shop for human services. Obviously, that's a little bias of an opinion. That's what that's my project. But one thing is being able to go somewhere and find stuff when you're looking for it. But another thing is you know, what are some things that we can do? So if you're, let's say, a single mom and you think you're going to lose your job, maybe some consultants came in and were asking hard questions, you'd be anxious for a couple of weeks, or you can try to find what, you know, what would happen if that situation were to occur. And I think it's all based, my theory is it's based on information design and making this type of information accessible, just like we do when we're trying to buy a home, when we're trying to buy insurance, and other things.
Well, and I would just say that the state, you've got to want people to be able to find services. And I don't think that the state of Texas has always been committed to that. And in fact, often it's the opposite, and it's led to a coining of a term, rationing by inconvenience. When people get services, it costs the state money. And so I think that we haven't done the best that we could do over the years to make services accessible, whether it's, you know, through word of mouth or paper flyers or the internet or social media. We haven't been committed to that. So the first step is to make people want to have your system be open and accessible. But I think your question about social media and access and is probably going to be the biggest challenge facing the state of Texas in this area as it moves forward, trying to create a system that's more efficient and at the same time really accessible. We know that a significant percentage of the clients of these services don't have even access to the internet. I know for people with disabilities that's a whole new set of challenges. And so the state's really going to need to figure out, in addition to creating a computer system that works and a user-friendly website, what else needs to be done to make sure that we kind of continue to try and close the digital divide. So if that's going to be our primary mode of giving people information about these services and getting them enrolled, are we doing what we need to do to make sure that people can take advantage of that? Our perspective has always been that there's always going to be a certain percentage of the population that uses these services that is not going to be able to do it without some kind of a live human being help assisting them, and that we need to design a system that works for that person in addition to a system that works for, you know, the savvy mom who has a job and potentially a chronically ill child who knows, I can't let my health insurance lapse. So they're doing everything that they do. It's part of their job to make sure their kid stays on health insurance. So those are two extremes, and we need a system that serves both.
I wanted to ask a question and then make a comment. Do you all know what platform this was built on? Because the title of this forum sort of led me to believe you'd discuss the failure of technology, but really this looks like a combination of political, you know, people involved in their will and intentions and a lack of organizational expertise or failure, purposefully or otherwise.
You mean technical architecture?
Well, what platform was the system that was to manage this built on? Was it SAP, Oracle, mainframe, a combination? Huh? Yeah. Well, you know Accenture was involved, but who else?
Well, the original vendor for TIERS, the computer system, or the current vendor, actually, it's a long contract, is Deloitte. And they were actually contracted with them in 1999. To build this system, so I think ultimately ended up costing close to $1 billion to get out. Do you know what platform it was on?
You know, I may have read somewhere, but it was sort of a Web 1.0 framework using Java, I believe.
Yeah.
There was a joke running. There was somebody had mentioned one point. That I had overheard, I don't remember who said it, but he said, you know, I sometimes wonder if we just don't go to the top of the building and just sort of throw money over. It's an interesting thought.
We don't really know which platform. I think the point, you know, maybe the comment I wanted to make is obviously this had a lot to do with political, you know, organizational. And that there's a systemic issue in the state for number four, which is test and evaluate, which has become, in most large corporations' experience, one of the most important areas to concentrate in. And so I know the state's still using a lot of outdated modes for test and evaluation. You know, I do happen to be in that business. I founded a company in 1998 does it, I'm not here to pitch it. But it's a real evident sort of old style of doing things that's not working.
Yeah, so would this now still be considered a legacy system? I mean, is it an ongoing, an injustice system?
I think it's a middle age system.
It's evolving, you know. It's evolving. And to the previous gentleman's point, the procurement process is a long process. It's difficult for young, small companies with big ideas to even get invited, you know, to even bid. There's a lot of requirements that make that difficult. But I believe it's a perpetual process. You know, you may have spent a lot of money on the technical system. But, you know, things change, and you know, I think the goal is to use the cost as a way to implementing those change, being able to drive down those costs.
When we talk about partnerships, the leadership and partnership, the responsibility on the vendor side, are they starting to identify those leaders in these negotiations and saying, you are just responsible?
I couldn't either. I'm sorry.
So your question is, are they identifying specific people on the private side that sort of help define the future? I think probably Celia can speak more on that.
I didn't hear the question.
Okay.
Sorry.
The question is, going forward in the future, is the state in the process of identifying sort of key people on the private sector side to help with the modernization going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to resources. And one of the things that happens when you, whether it's privatization or bringing in new kinds of technology, is that, you know, you have to ask the question, does the state have the capacity to even oversee something like this? And I think one of the problems with IT outsourcing is that the state doesn't always have the people in-house who can evaluate claims being made from vendors about their technology and will it work, and then when the contract's awarded, does the state even have the capacity to monitor and enforce it? And those were both problems, I think, in this contract with Accenture. And then I guess the other issue is, if they're bringing in expertise, how do you avoid conflict of interest? How do you make sure you're not bringing in the expert that's going to end up, you know, wanting to bid on the contract, and in which case are they giving you unbiased expert information? But really, I think, you know, we need to have, there's not a lot of money right now for states to even keep up with their current IT requirements. I mean, it's and this is just because of the state budget crisis that's hit Texas and every state in the country, but we've seen a lot of cuts in that area of state agencies, and we have, you know, I can count the number of agencies that have these huge MIS redesign projects that are just kind of stalled because they keep getting these change orders in that are costing lots of money, and they simply don't have the resources to do it. Just to give you an example with TIERS, which is an evolving system. It works well right now, but it's going to continue to need changes and have, fixes. The state has the capacity to do 3 builds a year in TIERS. So we have 3 opportunities each year to make changes, and a limited number of MIS hours to support making those changes. And so, as you might imagine, there's this long list of things that are waiting in line. And that's another challenge that states face when it comes to preventing a system from becoming a legacy before it's even rolled out, which may have happened with TIERS, is that we just don't have the resources or the capacity to stay at the cutting edge of technology.
And TIERS was developed before the idea of the call centers even came about, so it was never actually designed or the call center.
I think it takes people that are willing to get their hands dirty to really, really understand that process and to start asking the hard questions to make some technology changes. And it's confusing, and you're going to dig through lots of really badly written documents. But if you can do that and stay awake, you can ask some really hard questions. And I think the commission got a new chief information officer who's really trying to make things better. And I think... But it's up to us as citizens really to understand those details, because people's eyes glaze over. It's really thick stuff to read. But I firmly believe anybody can get in there and dig into those details and just, you know, It's hard work.
Well, in an answer to the question about the technical framework, in my training of how to answer questions from legislatures, you're taught to never pretend like you know the answer to something when you don't. Just say, I don't have the answer to that, but I'll get back to you. But I have found the document that lays out the technical framework for TIERS, and if you give me your email, I'll go ahead and email that for you and probably give you more information than you ever wanted.
Okay, so it's we have a hard stop at 12, and just on behalf of the panel, I just want to thank everybody for coming. And you know, I guess we'll be available afterwards if there's specific questions or you want to exchange cards. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.